Oh, more than possible, that the telephone call would come to light. Another possibility occurred to Dalgliesh. Could this have been precisely what Cain had intended? 12. After the fingerprinting, Emma collected some papers she needed from her guest set and was setting off for the library when she heard quick footsteps in the south cloister, and Raphael caught up with her. He said, "There's something I want to ask you. Is this a good time?" Emma was about to say, "If it isn't going to take too long," but after a glance at his face, stopped herself. She didn't know whether he was seeking comfort, but he certainly looked in need of it. She said instead, "It's a good time. But haven't you a tutorial with Father Peregrine?" "That's postponed. I've been sent for by the police. I'm on my way now to be grilled. That's why I needed to see you. I suppose you wouldn't be willing to tell Dalgliesh that we were together last night." "After 11 o'clock's the crucial time. I've got an alibi of sorts until then."
"Together where?"
"In your set or mine. I suppose I'm asking if you'd say that we slept together last night." Emma stopped walking and turned to face him. She said, "No, I wouldn't." "Raphael, what an extraordinary thing to ask. You're not usually so crass." "But not an extraordinary thing to do. Or is it?" She began striding quickly ahead, but he kept pace with her. She said, "Look, I don't love you, and I'm not in love with you." He broke in. "That's a nice distinction. But you might just think it possible. The idea might not utterly repel you." Emma turned to face him. "Raphael, if I had slept with you last night, I wouldn't be ashamed to admit it. But I didn't. I wouldn't, and I shan't lie. Apart from the morality of lying, it would be stupid and dangerous. Do you think it would deceive Adam Dalgliesh for a moment? Even if I were a good liar, and I'm not, he'd know. It's his business to know. Do you want him to think you killed the Archdeacon?" "He probably thinks it already. The alibi I've got isn't worth much. I went to keep Peter company, to help him through the storm. But he was asleep before midnight, and I could easily have crept out. I expect that's what Dalgliesh will believe I did do." Emma said, "Assuming he does suspect you, which I doubt, he'll certainly do so more strongly if you start fabricating an alibi. It's so unlike you, Raphael. It's stupid, pathetic, and insulting to both of us. Why?" "Perhaps I wanted to find out what you thought of the idea in principle." She said, "You don't sleep with a man in principle. You sleep with him in the flesh. And, of course, Father Sebastian wouldn't like it." He had spoken with casual irony, but Emma didn't miss the note of bitterness in his voice. She said, "Of course he wouldn't. You're one of his ordnance, and I'm a guest here. Even if I wanted to sleep with you, which I don't, it would be a breach of good manners." That made him laugh, but the sound was harsh. He said, "Good manners? Yes, I suppose that's a consideration. It's the first time I've been turned down with that excuse. The etiquette of sexual morality. Perhaps we should introduce a seminar into the ethics syllabus." She asked again, "But why, Raphael? You must have known what answer you'd get." "It's just that I thought that if I could make you like me, or perhaps even love me a little, I wouldn't be in such a muddle. Everything would be all right." She said more kindly, "But it wouldn't. If life is a muddle, we can't look for love to make it all come right." "But people do." They were standing together in silence outside the south door. Emma turned to go in. Suddenly Raphael stopped and took her hand and, bending, kissed her on the cheek. He said, "I'm sorry, Emma. I knew it was no good, really. I just had a dream. Please forgive me." He turned and she watched him striding back through the cloister and waited until he had passed through the iron gate. She let herself into the college, confused and unhappy. Could she have been more sympathetic, more understanding? Did he want to confide, and should she have encouraged him? But if things were going wrong for him, and she thought they were, what use was it looking to someone else to put them right? But in one sense, hadn't she done just that herself with Giles? Tired of the importunities, the demands for love, the jealousies and rivalries, Hadn't she decided that Giles, with his status, his strength, his intelligence, could provide her with at least a semblance of commitment, so that she could be left alone to get on with that part of her life which she valued most, her work? She knew now that it had been a mistake. It had been worse than a mistake. It had been wrong. After she returned to Cambridge, she would be honest with him. It wasn't going to be an agreeable parting. Giles wasn't used to rejection. But she wouldn't think further about it now. That future trauma was nothing compared to the tragedy at St. Anselm's, of which, inescapably, she was a part. 13. Just before 12 o'clock, Father Sebastian rang Father Martin, who was sitting in the library marking essays, and asked if he might have a word. This was his usual practice, to telephone personally. From the first days of his taking over as warden, he had been careful never to summon his predecessor through an ordinand or a member of staff. The new and very different reign would not be marked by a tactless exercise of authority. For most men, the prospect of a previous warden staying on in residence and in a part-time teaching post would have been to invite disaster. It had always been considered seemly for the outgoing warden not only to depart in well-organized dignity, but to take himself as far as possible from the college. But the arrangement with Father Martin, originally intended to be temporary to cover the unexpected departure of the lecturer in pastoral theology, had continued by mutual consent to the satisfaction of both parties. Father Sebastian had shown no inhibition or embarrassment in occupying his predecessor's stall in church, taking over and reorganizing his office, and sitting in his place at head of table, nor in introducing the changes he had carefully planned. Father Martin, unresentful and a little amused, perfectly understood. It would never have occurred to Father Sebastian that any predecessor could be a threat either to his authority or to his innovations. He neither confided in Father Martin nor consulted him. If he wanted information about administrative details, he got them from the files or from his secretary. The most confident of men, he could probably have accommodated the Archbishop of Canterbury on his staff in a junior capacity without difficulty. The relationship between him and Father Martin was one of trust and respect and, on Father Martin's part, of affection. As he had always found difficulty during his own stewardship in believing that he was in fact warden, he accepted his successor with goodwill and some relief. And if he sometimes hankered a little wistfully for a warmer relationship, it was not one he could envisage. But now, seated by invitation in his customary chair by the fireplace and watching Father Sebastian's unusual restlessness, he was uneasily aware that something was needed from him. Reassurance, advice, or just the mutual sympathy of shared anxiety. He sat very still and, closing his eyes, murmured a brief prayer. Father Sebastian stopped his pacing and said, "Mrs. Crampton left 10 minutes ago. It was a painful interview," he added. "Painful for both of us." Father Martin said, "It could not have been otherwise." He thought he detected in the warden's voice a small peevish note of resentment that the archdeacon had compounded his previous delinquencies by so inconsiderately getting himself murdered under their roof. The thought sparked off another, even more disgracefully irreverent thought. What would Lady Macbeth have said to Duncan's widow had that lady come to Inverness Castle to view the body? "A deplorable affair, madam, which my husband and I deeply regret. It was a most successful visit until then. We did all we could to make His Majesty comfortable." Father Martin was amazed and shaken that an idea so perversely inappropriate could have come into his mind. He must, he thought, be getting light-headed. Father Sebastian said, "She insisted on being taken to the church to see where her husband died. Unwise, I thought, but Commander Dalgleish gave in. She was adamant that she wanted him, not me, to accompany her. It was inappropriate, but I thought it expedient not to protest. Of course it must mean that she saw the doom. If Dalgliesh can trust her to keep quiet about the vandalism, why not trust my staff? Father Martin didn't like to say that Mrs. Crampton wasn't a suspect, and they were. Father Sebastian, as if suddenly aware of his restlessness, came and sat opposite his colleague. I was unhappy about her driving home alone and suggested that Stephen Morby might accompany her. Of course, it would have been inconvenient. He would have had to take the train back and then a taxi from Lowestoft. However, she preferred to be alone. I did ask if she would like to stay to lunch. She could have had it served quietly here or in my flat. The dining room would hardly have been suitable. Father Martin silently agreed. It would have been an uncomfortable meal, with Mrs. Crampton sitting among the suspects, and being politely passed the potatoes, perhaps by her husband's murderer. The warden said, "I'm afraid I failed her." One uses well-worn phrases on these occasions, but they cease to make any sense. Just a mutter of commonplace sounds with no reference to faith or meaning. Father Martin said, "Whatever you said, Father, no one could have done it better. There are occasions that go beyond words." Mrs. Crampton, he thought, would hardly have welcomed, or indeed needed, Father Sebastian's encouragement to Christian fortitude, or his reminder of Christian hope. Father Sebastian shifted uneasily in his chair, then willed himself into stillness. "I said nothing to Mrs. Crampton about my altercation with her husband in the church yesterday afternoon. It would have caused her additional distress and could have done no possible good. I regret it deeply. It is distressing to know that the Archdeacon died with such anger in his heart. It was hardly a state of grace for either of us." Father Martin said gently, "We cannot know, Father, what spiritual state the Archdeacon was in when he died." His companion went on, "I thought it a little insensitive of Dalgliesh to send his juniors to interview the priests. It would have been more appropriate had he spoken to us all himself. Naturally, I cooperated, as I am sure did everyone else. I could wish that the police seemed more open to the possibility that someone outside the college is responsible, although I'm reluctant to believe that Inspector Yarwood had anything to do with it. Still, the sooner he is able to speak, the better, and I'm naturally very anxious that the church should be reopened. The heart of the college hardly beats without it." Father Martin said, "I don't suppose we shall be let back until the doom has been cleaned, and perhaps that won't be possible. I mean, it may be needed in its present state as evidence." "That, of course, is ridiculous. Photographs have no doubt been taken, and they should be sufficient. The cleaning does, however, present a difficulty. It will be a job for experts. The doom is a national treasure. We could hardly let Pilbeam loose on it with a can of turpentine, and then there must be a service of re-hallowing before the church can be used. I've been to the library to look at the canons, but they offer remarkably little guidance. Canon F-15 deals with the profaning of churches, but gives no direction for re-sanctification. There's the Roman Rite, of course, and we could perhaps adapt that, but it is more complicated than seems appropriate. They envisage a procession, led by a cross-bearer, followed by the bishop with mitre and pastoral staff, concelebrants, deacons, and other ministers in proper liturgical vestiges, processing before the people into the church." Father Martin said, "I can't envisage the bishop wishing to take part. You have, of course, been in touch with him, Father." "Naturally. He's coming over on Wednesday evening. He very considerately suggested that any time earlier might be inconvenient both for us and for the police. He has, of course, spoken to the trustees, and I have little doubt what he will tell me formally when he arrives. St. Anselm's will close at the end of this term. He is hoping that arrangements can be made to accommodate the ordinance in other theological colleges. It is expected that Cuddeston and St. Stephen's House will be able to help, although not, of course, without difficulty. I've already spoken to the principals." Father Martin,
outraged, cried out in protest, but his old voice could produce only a humiliating quaver.
But that's appalling. It gives us less than 2 months. What about the pill beams, Surtees, our part-time staff? Are people going to be thrown out of their cottages?
Of course not, Father.
There was a trace of impatience in Father Sebastian's voice. St. Anselm's will close as a theological college at the end of this term, but the resident staff will be kept on until the future of the buildings has been settled. That will apply also to the part-time staff. Paul Perronet has been on the telephone to me and will come over with the other trustees on Thursday. He's adamant that nothing of value should be removed at present from either the college or the church. Miss Arbuthnot's will was very clear as far as her intentions are concerned, but undoubtedly the legal position will be complicated. Father Martin had been told the provisions of the will when he became warden. He thought, but didn't say, "We four priests will become rich men." How rich, he wondered. The thought horrified him. He found that his hands were shaking. Looking down at the veins like purple cords and the brown splotches which seemed more like the marks of a disease than the signs of old age, he felt his meagre store of strength ebbing away. Looking at Father Sebastian, he saw with a sudden illuminating insight a face pale and stoical, but a mind already assessing its future, wonderfully impervious to the worst ravages of grief and anxiety. This time there could be no reprieve. Everything Father Sebastian had worked and planned for was going down in horror and scandal. He would survive, but now, perhaps for the first time, he would have welcomed an assurance of it. They sat opposite each other in silence. Father Martin longed to find the appropriate words, but they wouldn't come. For 15 years, he hadn't once been asked for his advice, his reassurance, his sympathy, or his help. Now, when they were needed, he found himself powerless. His failure went deeper than this moment. It seemed to encompass his whole priesthood. What had he given to his parishioners, to the Ordinance, or St. Anselm's? There had been kindness, affection, tolerance, and understanding, but those were the common currency of all the well-intentioned. Had he, during the course of his ministry, changed a single life? He recalled the words of a woman overheard when he was leaving his last parish. "Father Martin is a priest of whom no one ever speaks ill." It seemed to him now the most damning of indictments. After a moment he got up, and Father Sebastian followed. He said, "Would you like me, Father, to take a look at the Roman Rite to see if it can be adapted for our use?" Father Sebastian said, "Thank you, Father. That would be helpful," and moved back to his chair behind the desk as Father Martin left the room and quietly closed the door behind him. 14. The first of the ordnance to be formally interviewed was Raphael Arbuthnot. Dalgliesh decided to see him with Kate. Arbuthnot took time responding to the summons, and it was 10 minutes before he was shown into the interview room by Robbins. Dalgliesh saw, with some surprise, that Raphael hadn't recovered himself. He looked as shocked and distressed as he had during the meeting in the library. Perhaps even this short lapse of time had brought home to him more forcibly the peril in which he stood. He moved as stiffly as an old man, and refused Dalgliesh's invitation to sit. Instead, he stood behind the chair, grasping the top with both hands, his knuckles as white as his face. Kate had the ridiculous notion that if she put out her hand to touch Raphael's skin or the curls of his hair, she would experience only unyielding stone. The contrast between the blonde Hellenic head and the stark black of the clerical cassock looked both hierarchic and theatrically contrived. Dalgliesh said, "No one could have sat at dinner last night as I did without realizing that you disliked the Archdeacon. Why?" It wasn't the opening that Arbuthnot had expected. Perhaps, thought Kate, he had mentally prepared himself for a more familiar academic gambit, innocuous preliminary questions about a candidate's personal history leading on to the more challenging inquisition. He stared fixedly at Dalgleish and was silent. It seemed impossible that any reply could come from those rigid lips. But when he spoke, his voice was under control. "I'd rather not say. Isn't it enough that I disliked him?" He paused, then said, "It was stronger than that. I hated him. Hating him had become an obsession. I realize that now. Perhaps I was deflecting onto him the hatred I couldn't admit to feeling for someone or something else, a person, a place, an institution." He managed a rueful smile and said, "If Father Sebastian were here, he'd say I'm indulging my deplorable obsession with amateur psychology." Kate said, her voice surprisingly gentle, "We do know about Father John's conviction." Was it his imagination, Dalgleish wondered, that the tension in Raphael's hands relaxed a little? "Of course. I'm being obtuse. I suppose you've checked on all of us." "Poor Father John. The recording angel has nothing on the police computer. So you now know that Crampton was one of the chief prosecution witnesses. It was he, not the jury, who sent Father John to prison." Kate said, "Juries don't send anyone to prison. The judge does that." She added, as if afraid that Raphael was about to faint, "Why don't you sit down, Mr. Arbuthnot?" After a moment of hesitation, he took the chair and made an obvious effort to relax. He said, "People one hates ought not to get themselves murdered. It gives them an unfair advantage. I didn't kill him, but I feel as guilty as if I did." Dalgleish said, "The passage of Trollope you read at dinner yesterday, was that your choice?"
"Yes, we always choose what to read."
Dalgleish said, "A very different archdeacon, another age. An ambitious man kneels beside his dying father and asks forgiveness for wishing him dead. It seemed to me that the archdeacon took it personally."
"He was intended to."
There was another silence. Then Raphael said,
"I'd always wondered why he pursued Father John so vehemently.
It isn't as if he was gay himself and suppressing it, terrified of exposure. Now I know he was vicariously purging his own guilt." Dalgleish said, "Guilt for what?"
"I think you'd better ask Inspector Yarwood."
Dalgleish decided not to pursue that line of questioning for the moment. This wasn't the only question that he needed to ask Yarwood. Until the inspector was fit to be interviewed, he was groping in the half-light. He asked Raphael exactly what he had done after Compton was finished.
"First of all, I went to my room. We're supposed to keep silence after Compton, but the rule isn't invariably obeyed. Silence doesn't mean not speaking to each other. We don't act like Trappist monks, but we do usually go to our rooms. I read and worked on an essay until 10:30. The wind was howling. Well, you know, sir, you were here, and I decided to go into the house to see if Peter, that's Peter Buckhurst, was all right. He's recovering from glandular fever, and he's far from well. I know he hates storms. Not the lightning or thunder or heavy rain, just the howling of the wind. His mother died in the room next door to him in a night of high wind when he was 7, and he's hated it ever since."
"How did you enter the house?"
"The usual way. My room is number 3 in the North Cloister. I went through the cloakroom, across the hall, and up the stairs to the second floor. There's a sick room there at the back of the house, and Peter's been sleeping in it for the last few weeks. It was obvious to me that he didn't want to be alone, so I'd said I'd stay there all night. There's a second bed in the sick room, so I slept there. I'd already asked Father Sebastian's permission to leave college after Compline. I'd promised to attend the first mass of a friend in a church outside Colchester, but I didn't like to leave Peter, so I decided to leave early this morning instead. The mass isn't until 10:30, so I knew I could make it."
Dalgleish asked, "Mr. Arbuthnot, why didn't you tell me this when we were in the library this morning?" "I asked if anyone had left his room after Compline."
"Would you have spoken? It would have been pretty humiliating for Peter, wouldn't it, letting the whole college know that he's frightened of the wind?"
"How did you spend the evening together?"
"We talked, and then I read to him. A sucky short story, if you're interested."
"Did you see anyone other than Peter Buckhurst after you entered the main building at about 10:30?
"Only Father Martin.
He looked in on us at about 11 o'clock, but he didn't stay. He was worried about Peter, too. Kate asked, was that because he knew Mr. Buckhurst was frightened of high winds?
It's the kind of thing Father Martin gets to know. I don't think anyone else at college knew except the two of us.
Did you return to your own room at any time during the night?
No.
There's a shower room attached to the sick bay if I wanted a shower. I didn't need pajamas.
Dalgliesh said, Mr. Arbuthnot, are you absolutely certain that you locked the door to the house from the north cloister when you went in to your friend?
I'm absolutely sure.
Mr. Pilbeam usually checks the doors at about 11 when he locks the front door. He'll be able to confirm that it was locked.
And you didn't leave the sick bay until this morning?
No.
I was in the sick bay all night. Peter and I put out our bedside lights at about midnight and settled down to sleep. I don't know about him, but I slept soundly. I woke just before 6:30 and saw that Peter was still asleep. I was on my way back to my room when I met Father Sebastian coming out of his office. He didn't seem surprised to see me, and he didn't ask why I hadn't left. I realize now that he had other things on his mind. He just told me to ring round everyone, ordnance, staff, and guests, and ask them to be in the library at 7:30. I remember I said, "What about morning prayer, Father?" And he replied, "Morning prayer is cancelled."
Dalgliesh asked, "Did he give you any explanation for the summons?"
"No, none. It wasn't till I joined everyone else in the library at 7:30 that I knew what had happened."
"And there's nothing else you can tell us? Nothing at all that could have any bearing on the Archdeacon's murder?"
There was a long silence, during which Arbuthnot gazed down at the hands clasped in his lap. Then, as if he had reached a decision, he raised his eyes and looked intently at Dalgliesh. He said, "You've been asking a lot of questions. I know that's your job. May I ask one now?"
Dalgliesh said, "Certainly, although I can't promise to answer it."
"It's this. It's obvious that you, the police I mean, believe that someone who slept in college last night killed the Archdeacon. You must have some reason for believing that. I mean, isn't it far more likely that someone from outside broke into the church, perhaps to steal, and was surprised by Crampton? After all, this place isn't secure. He'd have no difficulty in getting into the courtyard. He probably wouldn't have much difficulty in breaking into the house and getting a key to the church. Anyone who's ever stayed here could know where the keys are kept. So I'm just wondering why you're concentrating on us. I mean, the priests and the ordinance."
Dalgliesh said, "We've an open mind on who committed this murder. More than that, I can't tell you."
Arbuthnot went on, "You see, I've been thinking. Well, of course we all have. If anyone in college killed Crampton, it has to be me. No one else would or could. No one hated him as much, and even if they did, they aren't capable of murder. I'm wondering whether I could have done it without knowing. Perhaps I got up in the night and went back to my room, then saw him entering the church. Isn't it possible I could have gone after him, quarreled violently with him, and killed him?"
Dalgliesh's voice was calmly uninquisitive. "Why should you think that?"
"Because it's at least possible. If this is what you call an inside job, then who else could it have been? And there's one piece of evidence supporting it. When I went back to my room this morning after I'd phoned everyone to come to the library, I knew that someone had entered it during the night. There was a broken twig inside the door. Unless someone's removed it, it will still be there. Now you've closed the north cloister, I couldn't go back to check. I suppose it's evidence of a kind, but evidence of what?"
Dalgliesh asked, "Are you sure that the twig wasn't in your room when you left after Compline to go and check on Peter Buckhurst?"
"I'm sure it wasn't. I'd have noticed it. I couldn't have missed it. Someone entered that room after I left to see Peter. I must have gone back sometime in the night. Who else could it have been at that hour and in a storm?"
Dalgliesh said, "Have you ever in your life suffered from temporary amnesia?"
"No, never."
"And you're telling me the truth, that you say you have no recollection of killing the Archdeacon?"
"Yes, I swear it."
All I can tell you is that whoever committed this murder can be in no doubt what he or she did last night.
You mean that I would have woken this morning with blood on my hands, literally on my hands?
I mean no more than I've said. I think that's all for now. If you later remember anything new, please tell us at once.
The dismissal was summary, and Kate could see unexpected. Still keeping his eyes on Dalgleish, Arbuthnot murmured, "Thank you," and left. They waited until the front door had closed behind him. Dalgleish said, "Well, which is it, Kate? A consummate actor, or a worried and innocent young man?"
"I'd say he's a pretty good actor. With looks like that, you probably have to be.
I know that doesn't make him guilty. It's a clever story, though, isn't it? He more or less confesses to murder in the hope that he'll learn exactly how much we know. And his night with Buckhurst doesn't give him an alibi. He could easily have crept out when the boy was asleep, taken the keys to the church and rung the archdeacon. We know from Miss Betterton that he's good at imitating voices. He could have pretended to be any of the priests, and if he was seen in the house, well, no one would question his right to be there. Even if Peter Buckhurst woke up and found him gone, there's a good chance he wouldn't betray his friend. Much easier to make himself believe that the spare bed wasn't empty." Dalgleish said, "We'd better question him next. You and Piers can do that. But if Arbuthnot took the key, why not put it back when he returned to the house? A strong probability is that whoever killed Crampton didn't go back into college. Unless, of course, that's exactly what we're intended to believe. If Raphael did kill the Archdeacon, and until we've spoken to Yarwood he remains the chief suspect, his cleverest ploy would be to throw the key away. Did you notice that he didn't once mention Yarwood as a possible suspect? He's not stupid. He must realize the possible significance of Yarwood's disappearance. He can't be naive enough to assume that no police officer is ever capable of murder." Kate said, "And the twig inside his room?"
"He says it's still there, and no doubt it is. The question is, how did it get there and when?"
"It means that the Sarkos will have to extend the search area to Arbuthnot's room. If he's telling the truth, and it's an odd story, then the twig could be important. But this murder was carefully planned. If Arbuthnot had murder in mind, why complicate things by going to Peter Buckhurst's room? If his friend had been seriously distressed by the storm, Arbuthnot could hardly leave him, and he couldn't rely on the boy falling asleep, even at midnight. But if he was hoping to fabricate an alibi, Peter Buckhurst was probably his only chance. After all, a sick and frightened young man would be easy to deceive about the time. If Arbuthnot planned the murder for midnight, for example, he could easily murmur to Buckhurst when they settled down to sleep that it was after 12 o'clock. Which would only be helpful to him, Kate, if the pathologist could tell us more or less precisely when Crampton was killed. Arbuthnot hasn't an alibi, but that goes for everyone in college, including Yarwood. And he may hold the key to the whole business. We have to press on, but until he's fit enough to be interviewed, we could be missing vital evidence."
Kate asked, "You don't see him as a suspect, sir?"
"At present, he has to be. But he's an unlikely one. I can't see a man in such a precarious mental state planning and executing such a complicated crime. If finding Crampton so unexpectedly at St. Anselm's had roused him to a murderous rage, he could have struck him down in his bed."
"But that goes for all the suspects, sir."
"Exactly. We get back to the central question. Why was the murder planned in this way?" Nobby Clark and the photographer were at the door. Clark's face assumed a look of solemn reverence, as if he were entering a church. It was a sure sign that he had good news. Coming over to the table, he laid out polaroids of fingerprints, the index to the little finger of the right hand, and beside them a palm print, again of the right hand, this time showing the side of the thumb and four clear prints of the fingers. He laid a standard fingerprint form beside them. He said, "Dr. Stannard, sir, you couldn't hope for anything clearer.
the palm prints on the stone wall to the right of the doom, the other prints on the seat of the second box pew. We can take a palm print, sir, but it's hardly necessary with what we've got. No point in sending it off to HQ for verification. I've seldom seen clearer prints. They're Dr. Stannard's, all right.
XV. Pierce said, "If Stannard is Kane, this will be our shortest investigation to date. Back to the smoke. Pity, I was looking forward to dinner at the Crown and a pre-breakfast walk on the beach." Dalgleish was standing at the east window, looking out over the headland to the sea. Turning, he said, "I shouldn't give up hope of it." They had pulled out the desk from under the window and placed it in the middle of the room, with the two upright chairs behind it. Stannard would sit in the low armchair now brought forward to face the desk. He would be physically the most comfortable, but psychologically disadvantaged. They waited in silence. Dalgleish showed no inclination to talk, and Piers had worked with him long enough to know when to keep quiet. Robbins must be having difficulty in finding Stannard. It was nearly 5 minutes before they heard the front door opening. Robin said, "A Dr. Stannard, sir," and settled himself unobtrusively in the corner, notebook in hand. Stannard came in briskly, responding curtly to Dalgleish's good morning, and looked round as if wondering where he was expected to sit. Piers said, "This chair, Dr. Stannard." Stannard looked with deliberate intentness round the room, as if deploring its inadequacies, then sat, leaned back, appeared to decide that the assumption of ease was inappropriate, and resettled himself on the edge of the chair, legs clamped together, hands in his jacket pockets. His gaze, fixed on Dalgleish, was inquiring rather than belligerent, but Piers sensed his resentment and something stronger which he diagnosed as fear. No one is at his best when involved in an investigation of murder. Even reasonable and public-spirited witnesses, fortified by innocence, can come to resent the intrusion of police probing, and no one faces it with an entirely clear conscience. Minor and unrelated ancient delinquencies float to the surface of the mind like scum. Even so, Piers found Stannard singularly unprepossessing. It wasn't, he decided, only his prejudice against drooping moustaches. He just didn't like the man. Stannard's face, a thin, overlong nose and close-set eyes, had settled into deeply cleft lines of discontent. This was the face of a man who had never quite achieved what he felt was his due. What, Piers wondered, had gone wrong? The upper second degree instead of the expected first? A lectureship at an ex-polytechnic university instead of Oxbridge? Less power, less money, less sex than he felt he deserved? Probably not too little sex. Women unaccountably seemed attracted to this Che Guevara amateur revolutionary type. Hadn't he, at Oxford, lost his Rosie to just such a sour-faced wanker? Perhaps, he admitted, that was the cause of his prejudice. He was too experienced not to keep it under control, but even to admit to it gave him a perverted satisfaction. He had worked with Dalgleish long enough to know how this scene would be played. He would ask most of the questions. AD would come in when and as he chose. It was never what the witness expected. Piers wondered whether Dalgleish knew how intimidating was his dark, silent, watchful presence. He introduced himself, then began asking the usual preliminary questions in an even voice. Name, address, date of birth, occupation, marital state. Stannard's replies were short. At the end he said, "I don't see what relevance my marital state has to all this. Actually, I have a partner, female." Without replying, Piers asked, "And you arrived when, sir?" "Friday night for a long weekend. I'm due to leave before dinner tonight. I presume there's no reason why I shouldn't." "Are you a regular visitor, sir?" "Fairly. During the last 18 months or so, the occasional weekends." "Could you be more specific?" "About half a dozen visits, I suppose." "When were you last here?"
a month ago. I forget the exact date. Then I arrived Friday night and stayed until Sunday. Compared with this weekend, it was uneventful.
Dalgliesh interposed for the first time. Why do you visit, Dr. Stannard?
Stannard opened his mouth, then hesitated. Piers wondered whether he'd been about to reply, "Why shouldn't I?" and had thought better of it. The answer, when it did come, sounded as if it had been carefully prepared.
"I'm researching a book on the family life of the early Tractarians, covering both their childhood and youth, their later marriages, if any, and their family life. The intention is to explore early experience with religious development and sexuality. As this is an Anglo-Catholic institution, the library is particularly useful, and I have an entry to it. My grandfather was Samuel Stannard, a partner in the firm of Stannard, Fox and Perronet in Norwich. They have represented St. Anselm's since its foundation, and the Arbuthnot family before that. Coming here, I combine research with an agreeable weekend break."
Piers asked, "How far has research progressed?"
"It's at an early stage. I don't get much free time. Contrary to popular belief, academics are overworked."
"But you have papers with you. Evidence of work done so far?"
"No, my papers are in college,"
Piers said. "These visits, I would have thought you had exhausted the possibilities of the library here. What about other libraries? The Bodleian?"
Stannard said sourly, "There are libraries other than the Bodleian."
"True. There's Pusey House at Oxford. I believe they have a remarkable Tractarian collection. The librarian there should be able to help." He turned to Dalgliesh.
"And there's London, of course. Is the Dr. Williams Library in Bloomsbury still in existence, sir?"
Before Dalgliesh could reply, if he intended to, Stannard broke out,
"What the hell business is it of yours where I choose to do my research? And if you're trying to show that occasionally the Met recruits educated officers, forget it. I'm not impressed."
Piers said, "Just trying to be helpful."
"So you visited here some half-dozen times in the last 18 months to work in the library and enjoy a recuperative weekend. Has Archdeacon Crampton been here on any of those previous occasions?"
"No. I never met him until this weekend. He didn't arrive until yesterday. I don't know when exactly, but the first I saw of him was at tea. Tea was laid out in the students' sitting room, and the room was pretty full when I arrived at 4. Someone, I think it was Raphael Arbuthnot, introduced me to the people I hadn't met, but I didn't feel inclined to chat, so I took a cup of tea and a couple of sandwiches and went to the library. That old fool, Father Peregrine, took his head out of his book long enough to tell me that food and drink weren't allowed in the library. I went to my room. I saw the Archdeacon next at dinner. After dinner, I worked in the library until they all went to Compline. I'm an atheist, so I didn't join them."
"And you learned of the murder when?"
"Just before 7. When Raphael Arbuthnot rang to say that a general meeting had been called and that we were to assemble in the library at 7:30. I didn't much care for being spoken to as if I were back at school, but I thought I might as well see what it was all about. As far as the murder is concerned, I know less than you."
Piers asked, "Have you ever attended any of the services here?"
"No, I haven't. I came here for the library and for a quiet weekend, not to attend services. It doesn't seem to worry the priests, so I don't see why it should concern you."
Piers said, "Oh, but it does, Dr. Stannard. It does.
Are you telling us that you have never, in fact, been in the church?"
"No, I'm not saying that. Don't put words into my mouth. I may have looked in out of curiosity on one of the visits. I've certainly seen the inside, including the doom, which has some interest for me. I'm saying I have never attended a service."
Without looking up from the paper before him, Dalgliesh asked, "When were you last in the church, Dr. Stannard?"
"I can't remember. Why should I? Not this weekend, anyway."
"And when during this weekend did you last see Archdeacon Crampton?"
"After church. I heard some of them coming back about 10:15. I was in the students' sitting room watching a video. There was nothing worth seeing on television, and they have a small collection of videos. I put on 4 weddings and a funeral. I'd seen it before, but I thought it was worth a second viewing. Crampton looked in briefly, but I wasn't exactly welcoming, so he made off.
Pierce said, "So you must have been the last person, or one of the last people, to see him alive."
"Which I suppose you regard as suspicious. I wasn't the last person to see him alive. His murderer was. I didn't kill him."
"Look, how often do I have to say it? I never knew the man. I'd no quarrel with him, and I didn't go near the church yesterday evening. I was in bed by 11:30. After the video finished, I went out by the door into the south cloister and to my room. The gale was at its height by then, and it wasn't a night for taking a last breath of sea air. I went straight to my set. It's number 1 in the south cloister."
"Was there a light in the church?"
"Not that I noticed. Come to think of it, I didn't see any lights from the ordnance rooms or the guest suites. There was the usual, rather dim light in both cloisters."
Pierce said, "You'll understand that we need to get as complete a picture as possible of what happened in the hours before the Archdeacon was killed. Did you hear or notice anything which could be significant?"
Stannard gave a mirthless laugh.
"I imagine a hell of a lot was happening, but I can't see into people's minds. I did get the impression that the Archdeacon wasn't exactly welcome, but no one made murderous threats to him in my hearing."
"Did you speak to him at all after that introduction at tea?"
"Only to ask him to pass the butter at dinner. He passed it. I'm not good at small talk, so I concentrated on the food and wine, which were superior to the company. Not exactly a cheerful meal. It wasn't the usual happy, all boys together under God, or under Sebastian Morel, which means the same thing. But your boss was there. He'll tell you about dinner."
Pierce said, "The commander knows what he saw, Ned. We're asking you."
"I've told you, not a cheerful meal. The ordnance seemed subdued. Father Sebastian presided with icy courtesy, and some people had difficulty in keeping their eyes off Emma Lavenham, for which I can't say I blame them. Raphael Arbuthnot read a passage from Trollope. Not a novelist, I know, but it seemed pretty innocuous to me. Not to the Archdeacon, however. And if Arbuthnot wanted to embarrass him, he chose the right time. It's difficult to pretend you're enjoying a meal when your hands are shaking and you look as if you're about to stick it up over the plate. After dinner, they all beetled off to church, and that was the last I saw of any of them until Crampton looked in on me when I was watching the video."
"And you saw or heard nothing suspicious during the night?"
"You asked that when we were together in the library. If I'd seen or heard anything suspicious, I'd have come forward before now."
It was Piers who asked the question this time.
"And you haven't set foot in the church during this visit, either for a service or at any other time?"
"How many times have I got to keep telling you the answer is no, 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 no?"
Dalgleish looked up and met Stannard's eyes.
"Then how do you explain the fact that your fresh fingerprints are on the wall next to the doom and on the seat of the second box pew? The dust under the pew has been disturbed. It is highly likely the forensic scientists will find some traces of it on your jacket. Is that where you were hiding when the Archdeacon came into the church?" And now Piers saw real terror. As always, it unnerved him. He felt no triumph, only shame. It was one thing to put a suspect at a disadvantage, another to witness this transformation of a man into a terrified animal. Stannard seemed physically to shrink, a thin, undernourished child in a chair too large for him. His hands were still in his pockets. Now he tried to wrap them round his body. The thin tweed stretched, and Pierce thought he heard the rip of the lining seam. Dalgleish said quietly, "The evidence is incontrovertible. You've been lying since you came into this room. If you didn't murder Archdeacon Crampton, you would be wise to tell the truth now, all the truth." Stannard didn't reply. He had taken his hands from his pockets and now clasped them in his lap. With his head bent above them, he looked incongruously like a man at prayer. He appeared to be thinking, and they waited in silence.
When at last he lifted his head and spoke, it was apparent that he had mastered the extremity of fear and was ready to fight back. Piers heard in his voice a mixture of obstinacy and arrogance.
"I didn't kill Crampton. And you can't prove that I did. All right. I lied about not visiting the church. That was natural. I knew that if I told the truth, you'd immediately seize on me as the prime suspect. It's all very convenient for you, isn't it? The last thing you want is to pin this on anyone at St. Anselm's. I'm tailor-made to be fitted up. Those priests are sacrosanct."
"Well, I didn't do it," Piers said.
"Then why were you in the church?
You could hardly expect us to believe you went there to pray." Stannard didn't reply. He seemed to be steeling himself for the inevitable explanation, or perhaps selecting the most convincing and appropriate words. When he spoke, he looked fixedly at the far wall, carefully avoiding Dalgleish's eyes. His voice was controlled, but with a barely concealed note of petulant self-justification.
"All right. I accept that you have a right to an explanation and that I have a duty to provide it. It's perfectly innocent and nothing to do with Crampton's death. That being so, I would be grateful for your assurance that this interview is confidential."
Dalgleish said, "You know we can't give you that."
"Look, I've told you it had nothing to do with Crampton's death. I only met him for the first time yesterday. I'd never seen him before. I had no quarrel with him and no reason to wish him dead. I dislike violence. I'm a pacifist, and not just by political conviction."
Dalgleish said, "Dr. Stannard, will you please answer my question? You were hiding in the church. Why?"
"I'm trying to tell you. I was looking for something. It's a document, usually referred to by the few in the know as the St. Anselm Papyrus. It's reputed to be an order ostensibly signed by Pontius Pilate to the captain of the guard, ordering the removal of the crucified body of a political troublemaker. Naturally, you can see its importance. It was given to the founder of St. Anselm's, Miss Arbuthnot, by her brother, and has been in the custody of the warden ever since. The story is that the document is a fake, but since no one is allowed to see it or submit it to scientific examination, the question is open. Obviously, the document is of interest to any genuine scholar," Peel said.
"Like yourself, for example. I didn't realize you were an expert in pre-Byzantine manuscripts. Aren't you a sociologist?"
"That doesn't prevent me from having an interest in church history,"
Piers went on. "So, knowing that you were unlikely to be given a sight of the document, you decided to steal it."
Stannard gave Piers a look of concentrated malevolence. He said with heavy irony, "I believe the legal definition of theft is taking with the intention of permanently depriving the owner of possession. You're a police officer. I should have thought you'd have known that."
Dalgleish said, "Dr. Stannard, your rudeness may be natural to you, or you may find it a pleasurable, if childish, release of tension, but it is inadvisable to indulge it when involved in a police investigation of murder. So, you went to the church. Why did you think the papyrus was hidden in the church?"
"It seemed the natural place. I'd been going through the books in the library, at least as far as possible, with Father Peregrine permanently there and noticing everything while pretending to notice nothing. I thought it was time to turn attention elsewhere. It occurred to me that the document could have been hidden behind the doom. I went to the church yesterday afternoon. The college is always quiet on Saturdays after luncheon."
"How did you get into the church?"
"I had keys. I was here just after Easter when most of the ordinands were away and Miss Ramsay was on leave. I borrowed the church keys, a Chubb and a Yale, from the outer office and got them cut in Lowestoft. They weren't missed in the couple of hours it took. If they had been, I planned to say that I'd found them lying in the south cloister. Anyone could have dropped them."
"You thought of everything. Where are these keys now?"
"After Sebastian Morel's bombshell in the library this morning, I decided they weren't exactly the kind of thing I'd like to have found on me. If you must know, I chucked them away.
To be more accurate, I wiped them of fingerprints and buried them under a clump of grass on the edge of the cliff.
Pierce said, would you be able to find them again?
Probably. It might take a bit of time, but I know where I buried them within, say, 10 yards.
Doug Leash said, then you'd better find them.
Sergeant Robbins will go with you.
Pierce asked, and what did you propose doing with the St. Anselm papyrus if you found it?
Copying it. Writing an article about it for the broadsheets and in the academic press. I proposed bringing it where any document of that importance ought to be. In the public domain.
Pierce said, for cash, for academic glory, or for both.
Stannard's look at him was positively venomous. If I'd written a book as I had in mind, obviously it would make money.
Money, fame, academic prestige, your picture in the broadsheets. People have murdered for less.
Before Stannard could expostulate, Dalgleish said, I take it that you didn't find the papyrus.
No. I took a long wooden paper knife with me, hoping to dislodge whatever might be hidden between the doom and the church wall. I was standing on one of the chairs to reach up when I heard someone coming into the church. I quickly replaced the chair and hid.
Apparently you already know where.
Pierce said. The second box pew. Schoolboys' games. A bit humiliating, wasn't it? Couldn't you just have sunk to your knees? No, perhaps a pretense of prayer wouldn't have been convincing.
And confess that I'd got keys to the church? Oddly enough, that didn't seem to be an option.
He turned to Dalgleish.
But I can prove I'm telling the truth. I didn't watch to see who was coming in, but when they moved up the central aisle to the nave, I heard them clearly. It was Morell and the Archdeacon. They were arguing over the future of St. Anselm's. I could probably reproduce most of the conversation. I've got a good memory for speech, and they weren't bothering to keep their voices down. If you're looking for someone with a grudge against the Archdeacon, you don't need to look far. One of the things he was threatening was to get the valuable altarpiece moved out of the church.
Pierce asked, in a tone which could have been mistaken for genuine interest, what explanation were you proposing to give if they had happened to look under the seat of the pew and found you? I mean, you've obviously thought things through very thoroughly. Presumably you had some explanation ready.
Stannard treated the inquiry as he might have an unintelligent intervention from a not very promising pupil. The suggestion is ridiculous. Why should they have searched the pew? Even if they'd looked in the pew, why should they have bothered to kneel down and search under the seat? If they had, obviously I should have been in an embarrassing position.
Dalgleish said, you're in an embarrassing position now, Dr. Stannard. You admit to one unsuccessful attempt to search the church. How can we be sure that you didn't return again late last night?
I give you my word that I didn't. What else can I say?
And then he added truculently, and you can't prove that I did.
Pierce said, you said you used a wooden paper knife to prod behind the doom. Are you sure that's all you used? Didn't you go into the kitchen at St. Anselm's that night while the community were at Compline and take a carving knife?
And now Stannard's careful nonchalance, the barely concealed truculence and arrogance, gave way to frank terror. The skin round the moist, over-red mouth was a white penumbra, and the cheekbones stood out scarred with red lines against skin which was drained into an unhealthy greenish grey. He turned his whole body to Dalgleish with a vehemence which nearly overturned the chair.
My God, Dalgleish, you've got to believe me. I didn't go into the kitchen. I couldn't stick a knife into anyone, not even an animal. I couldn't slit the throat of a cat. It's ludicrous. It's appalling to suggest it. I was in the church only once, I swear it, and all I had with me was a wooden paper knife. I can show it to you. I'll get it now.
He half rose from his chair and gazed with desperate appeal from one set face to the other. No one spoke. Then he said, with a small surge of hope and triumph, there's something else. I think I can prove I didn't go back. I rang my girlfriend in New York at 11:30 our time. The relationship has hit a sticky patch, and we have been speaking by phone nearly every day.
I used my mobile, and I can give you her number. I wouldn't spend a half hour speaking to her if I was planning to murder the Archdeacon.
No, said Piers. Not if the murder was planned.
But gazing into Stannard's terrified eyes, Dalgliesh knew that here was one suspect who could almost certainly be eliminated. Stannard had no idea how the Archdeacon had died.
Stannard said, I'm due back at university tomorrow morning. I was planning to leave tonight. Pilbeam was going to drive me to Ipswich. You can't keep me here. I've done nothing wrong.
Getting no response, he added in a voice half propitiatory, half angry,
Look, I've got my passport with me. I always carry it. I don't drive, so it's useful for identification. I suppose if I gave it up temporarily, there's no objection to letting me go.
Dalgliesh said, Inspector Tarrant will take charge of it and give you a receipt. This isn't the end of the matter, but you are free to go.
And I suppose you're going to tell Sebastian Morel what happened?
No, said Dalgliesh. You are.
16. Dalgliesh, Father Sebastian, and Father Martin met in Father Sebastian's office. Father Sebastian had remembered almost word for word the conversation between him and the Archdeacon in the church. He spoke the dialogue as if reciting something learned by rote, but Dalgliesh didn't miss the note of self-disgust in his voice. At the end, the warden was silent, giving no explanation and offering no extenuation. During the recital, Father Martin sat quietly in a fireside chair, with his head bowed, as still and attentive as if he were hearing a confession. There was a pause. Dalgliesh said, Thank you, Father. That agrees with the account given by Dr. Stannard. Father Sebastian said, Forgive me if I'm intruding on your field of responsibility, but the fact that Stannard was hidden in the church yesterday afternoon doesn't mean that he didn't return late that night. Do I take it that you have exonerated him from the inquiry? Dalgliesh had no intention of revealing that Stannard had been ignorant of how the Archdeacon had died. He was wondering whether Father Sebastian had forgotten the significance of the missing key, when the warden said, Obviously, having made a copy of the key, he didn't need to take one from the office, but surely he could have done that simply to throw suspicion elsewhere. Dalgliesh said, That would be to assume, of course, that the murder was planned in advance and was not an impulse of the moment. Stannard isn't exonerated. At present, no one is. But I've told him that he can leave, and I imagine that you'll be glad to see the last of him.
Very glad. We were beginning to suspect that his explanation for being with us, his research into the domestic life of the early Tractarians, was a cover for another interest. Father Peregrine in particular was suspicious. But Stannard's grandfather was a senior partner in the firm of solicitors who had dealt with the college since the 19th century. He did a great deal for us, and we were loath to disoblige his grandson. Perhaps the Archdeacon was right. We are too apt to be enthralled to our past. My meeting with Stannard was not comfortable. His attitude was a mixture of bluster and sophistry. He offered a not unusual excuse for cupidity and dishonesty, the sanctity of historical research.
Father Martin hadn't spoken during the whole of the interview. He and Dalgliesh left the outer office in silence. Once outside, he stopped short and asked, Would you like to see the Anselm Papyrus?
Yes, very much.
I keep it in my sitting room.
They climbed the circular staircase to the tower. The view was spectacular, but the room wasn't comfortable. It gave the impression of being furnished with odd pieces too old to be on public view, but too good to throw away. Such an expedient jumble can produce an atmosphere of cheerful intimacy, but here it was depressing. Dalgliesh doubted whether Father Martin even noticed. On the wall, which faced north, there was a small religious print in a brown leather frame. It was difficult to see clearly, but at first sight it had little artistic merit, and the colours were so weak that it was difficult to make out even the central figure of the Virgin and Child.
Father Martin took it down and slid off the top of the frame. He drew out the print. Beneath it were two panes of glass, and between them what looked like a sheet of thick cardboard, cracked and broken at the edges and covered with rows of scratched and spiky black lettering. Father Martin didn't carry it over to the window, and Dalgliesh had difficulty in deciphering any of the Latin except for the superscription. There seemed to be a round circular mark in the right-hand corner where the papyrus had broken away. He could clearly see the criss-cross of the compounded reeds from which it was made. Father Martin said, "It has only been examined once, and that soon after Miss Arbuthnot received it. There seems no doubt that the papyrus itself is old, almost certainly dating from the 1st century A.D. Her brother Edwin would have had no difficulty in getting hold of it. He was, as I expect you know, an Egyptologist." Dalgliesh said, "But why did he hand it over to his sister? It seems a curious thing to have done, whatever its provenance. If it was faked, to discredit her religion, why keep it secret? If he thought it was genuine, wasn't that an even better reason for making it public?" Father Martin said, "That's one of the chief reasons why we've always regarded it as a fake. Why part with it when, if genuine, he would have got fame and prestige from its discovery? He may, of course, have wanted his sister to destroy it. He had probably kept photographs, and had she done so, could have accused the college of deliberately destroying a papyrus of incomparable importance. She was probably wise to act as she did. His motives are less explicable." Dalgliesh said, "There's also the question of why Pilate would bother to put the command in writing. Surely a word in the right ear would have been the normal way."
"Not necessarily. I don't have the same difficulty with that."
Dalgliesh said, "But the matter could now be settled one way or the other, if that's what you wish. Even if the papyrus dates back to the time of Christ, the ink could be carbon-dated. It's possible now to know the truth." Father Martin, with great care, was putting the print and the frame together again. Finally he hung the picture on the wall and stood back, assessing that he had replaced it evenly. He said, "You believe then, Adam, that the truth can never hurt?" "I wouldn't say that, but I believe we have to search for it, however unwelcome it may be when we find it."
"That's your job, a searching for truth."